Welcome to Ancient Future Faith with Dr. Chris Alford, pastor of Epiclesis, an ancient future faith community in Sacramento. Just what is ancient future Christian faith? Join Chris each week as he talks with special guests about a refreshing renewal in evangelical worship and spirituality that's helping many believers get in touch with their ancient Christian heritage. Now, with another look at how the road to the evangelical future runs through the ancient past, here's Dr. Chris Alford.
Well, hi, everybody, and welcome back once again to another edition of Ancient Future Faith. My name is Chris Alford. I'm the blessed guy who gets to be the pastor of Epiclesis, an ancient future faith. By the way, what in the world is an epiclesis anyway? Well, if you want to learn more about our church, I'd love for you to pop over to the website epiclesis.org. That's spelled E-P-I-C-L-E-S-I-S. We're a pre-denominational Christian evangelical church that believes that the road to the future runs through our Christian past. Love you to check it out. I'm also the host, by the way, of this program brought to you by Epiclesis. We come to you each week on KFI Radio on Monday afternoons at 4 o'clock. And our mission here is to bring you a variety of guests to talk about this thing called ancient future faith. Well, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the studios a dear friend. She's also a published author and a lawyer and a mom and a lot of other nifty things. Susan Spann, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the program again.
Oh, it is. You know, this is the second time, right? I think
it might even be the third time.
Yeah, I do too. Listen, folks, I don't want to waste our broadcast time going back and catching up on things we've talked about already, although Susan will probably have to touch on at least a little bit of it. But I want to encourage people to go to the epiclesis.org website and click on resources. You'll find there all kinds of audio resources, including archived recordings of Ancient Future Faith on KFIA Radio. And you'll see there some interviews that we did with Susan Spann about her wonderful collection of books. They're called the Shinobi Mysteries. And Susan, you're celebrating a big event, what, this week, isn't it?
Tomorrow. The fourth book in the series, which is titled The Ninja's Daughter, releases tomorrow from 7th Street Books.
Folks, listen, I'll probably say it several times in the broadcast, but I really want to encourage you to zip over to Amazon.com or your local booksellers and find Susan Spann. That's S-P-A-N-N. And the series is called The Shinobi Mysteries. This latest book is called The Ninja's Daughter, but there are three other before it. Susan, those titles right quick like for us.
Yes, the first book is called Claws of the Cat, and it was followed by Blade of the Samurai, and the final one was Flask of the Drunken Master.
Now, folks, here's the place where it ties in with ancient future faith. You may be asking yourself, how in the world does ninja murder mysteries have anything to do with ancient future faith? But Susan, you and I have this conversation all the time, and we're often marveling at how often you get to fiddle with some of these interesting themes, yes?
Yes, partly because although the primary detective in my series is a ninja, or a shinobi in Japanese, his sidekick, who is truly more of a partner than a sidekick, is Father Mateo Avila de Santos, a Portuguese Jesuit priest.
All right, and so we should say that the setting of these novels comes in 16th century Japan, and this priest, Mateo, is teamed up, as fate would have it, with a ninja who solves murders. And in those situations, Susan, you've been able to put them together in, well, goodness, all kinds of different opportunities for them to talk about things. But faith and or themes that touch on faith occur pretty often, don't they?
Well, they do, in part because my protagonist, Hiro and Father Mateo, are two men who both have very highly developed senses of honor that spring from very different places.
Mm.
And I love being able to contrast the difference between someone whose primary worldview is based on faith, based on religion, which would be Father Mateo, versus someone whose primary worldview is much more pragmatic. Hiro is actually an agnostic. He does not much know or care what goes on in the spiritual realm unless it impacts his ability to survive and to keep the priest alive. And so the contrast between those two worldviews is interesting to me, and I love being able to explore the way that even people who view the world differently can nonetheless find common ground and get along.
Well, it reminds me of this post-Christian world that we live in. Even here in North America, we have certainly a clash of worldviews and cultures and so on, right in our own backyard. And you've been given the wonderful opportunity to see how two people from very different faith and worldviews come together and interact. I love that. I love that aspect of the books.
One of the things that you notice if you turn on the television or Facebook or any of the modern media, is how poorly people get along. And, you know, it sounds cliched, but it hurts my heart. It hurts my heart to see that people fight with one another and hate one another without actually knowing one another. And one of the things that I think is very important, especially for people who want to root their lives and their worldview in a Christian perspective, is to remember that the ultimate message here is not hate your neighbor. That is the opposite of what people are supposed to be doing. And so I love the fact that I can have these characters who can illustrate something that's very close to my heart, which is that a true march through a Christian life should be focused on understanding and love. And while that doesn't necessarily mean you have to agree with someone, mm-hmm. it definitely means you don't have to hate them.
You're listening to an interview with author Susan Spann. The fourth in her wonderful series of books called The Shinobi Mysteries comes out this week. It's called The Ninja's Daughter, and I'm interviewing her here on Ancient Future Faith because there are some really interesting themes that come along, not only in this novel, but also in the other three. Again, pop over to the Epiclesis website and look up the previous conversations that Susan and I had about these books because we touch on several ancient future themes in the books. But one that I want to talk about today is the no drama. Now, when we say no drama, people probably think we're saying we don't want any drama around here, right? But we're talking actually about a very ancient and highly regarded Japanese art form called the no drama or no play. Could you just give us a little bit of background on what that is? And then I want to tell you why it sprang to mind.
Absolutely. No is a form of traditional Japanese theater, as you mentioned. It is actually the oldest form of traditional theater that is currently in widespread practice today.
Oh, anywhere.
Yes, it is. Mm. It was developed during the 11th century. It was originally called Nogaku, and it developed out of two separate theatrical forms. But No consists of a troupe of actors, normally accompanied by flutes and drums, as well as a chorus of chanted voices. And the plays are based on traditional stories from Japanese literature, and normally feature one actor called the shite, who works as the primary narrator for the tale. And the shite would either act a role of a god or a woman or an elderly man or a demon. And in this role, he or she would normally have a transformation. In the first act, the character is relating one part of a story. There's a transformation, usually very dramatic and physical and accompanied by a costume change for the actor. And then in the second act of the play, the actor reflects on this transformation and how it impacts their life in the story. And it's a very interesting form of drama, but it's also highly impenetrable for a modern audience.
How do you mean?
Well, even in Japan, the language that's used in No is traditional Japanese, which is different from modern Japanese.
What, more archaic somehow? Or?
Yes, the words are more archaic. They are more difficult to understand when pronounced. And the entire play is chanted in a very old style that involves long, drawn-out syllables. And very often, modern audiences actually have to use a libretto to read along, or they have to know the story in order to fully understand what's going on in the drama. Mm. It is not uncommon for people to fall asleep in No performances.
And we should mention that these go on for hours, is that right?
Yes, each play typically takes between 60 and 90 minutes to put on. However, traditionally, No was performed on religious occasions or special occasions. It was often sponsored by samurai who would pay a theater troupe to put on a day or 2 days of performances. It would have been performed at a private home or in a temple, and they would put on somewhere between 5 and 7 plays in a day, interspersed with shorter comedic dramas called kyogen, which were performed in between the no plays almost as a palate cleanser.
Well, folks, I think that you can probably already pick up some liturgical themes here, right? I mean, you have a story that many people know. You've got highly symbolic motions and movement. To some people, it might seem impenetrable. You see where I'm going on this, yeah, Susan?
Oh, it has absolutely nothing to do with modern worship.
Well, okay, here's why I got to thinking about no drama. Recently, I took a trip back east, and I had the opportunity to visit several different church services. And in one particular church, it occurred to me that what I was looking at was very much like no drama. And I realized something that really made me quite sad. It occurs to me that so much of the liturgy that we present, and Susan, every church has a liturgy, whether they think they're highly developed or not, it broke my heart to think that so much of what we are presenting today in terms of worship is very much like this no drama. It tells a story that people really don't necessarily know, and you can't appreciate what's going on unless you do know the story. One church service that I went to was highly symbolic, and every person and every place and every object had a meaning, but it was kind of like an inside joke. I don't mean joke, but inside story. You're following me, I think.
Absolutely.
Where everybody in the audience, as it were, the congregation, who've been there for years and years and years and years, understands what's happening here, but someone who is an outsider is not going to be able to latch onto the story or the meaning or ultimately the ultimate good of the thing unless they're given tools to understand. And by the way, the irony is that this was not a liturgical church. In fact, this was a church that would be shocked and dismayed and argue with you if you said that they even had a liturgy. Does any of that make sense?
You know, it resonates with me on a number of levels. One of the most beautiful aspects of no drama is that the Japanese people who practice it have managed to bring the culture and the tradition down through the generations with so little change that it still preserves this beautiful, masterful retelling of these very traditional stories. And if you understand what you're looking at when you look at no drama, it is spectacular. I mean, it's a wonderful, meaningful, rich form of drama. And every gesture is laden with meaning. And when you watch it, the fact that there is so much meaning and so much subtext gives so much experiential value for the viewer, if the viewer knows what they're looking at. And I agree with you that that is both a blessing and a curse, and it absolutely carries through to modern worship. I think one of the challenges of worship, as with no drama, is to preserve the meaning of the original story and to preserve the beauty in the form, because it is spectacularly beautiful, while still finding a way to educate the viewer so that the viewer doesn't simply become bored or disinterested or feel disenfranchised. And I think that's one of the very, very big challenges that faces both faith and modern no. How do you engage a first-time viewer without cheapening the story or taking away from its deeper meaning?
I'm looking at chapter 38 of your present book called The Ninja's Daughter, and it has a wonderful chapter or two where Father Mateo and Hiro are observing a no drama, and it's really interesting for Father Mateo, who is in some ways a purveyor of drama in terms of liturgy that would have probably been impenetrable to a Japanese person, is now watching a kind of stylized spectacle that is certainly impenetrable to him. And I'm reading in chapter 38, the performer continued his warbling chant as Hiro and Father Mateo watched. "What play is this?" Father Mateo whispered. "Do you know it?" Hiro nodded, still watching the stage. "It's based on the tale of Genji." And then he goes into this description of what the story is about. It's very complicated, and if you didn't know the story ahead of time, you probably wouldn't get it. And all along the way, Father Mateo is saying, "Okay, that doesn't make any sense," or, "Okay, so why is the kimono empty on the stage?" He doesn't really understand what's going on. I loved that interaction.
You know, that interaction was great fun for me to write for two reasons. I wanted to simultaneously show its beauty and show, with a sense of humor, that it is admittedly difficult for people who don't have an entrance to it to understand. As a secondary issue, I had great fun with letting the priest be the person riffing on the fact that what he was watching, though deeply meaningful to Hiro, was impenetrable to him, because it was a reversal. And some of the things that I have Father Mateo say are actually things that people say about Christian worship services. And one of the reasons I did that was deliberately. It appealed to my sense of humor, because to let the priest have the reaction that other people have to him appealed to my sense of irony.
Okay, what are some of those things that people say about Christian worship services that Father Mateo now gets to say about this odd Japanese drama?
Well, first of all, you mentioned the empty kimono. In this play, there's an empty kimono lying on the stage, and it symbolizes a character who is not physically present. And I think that a lot of people look at Christian worship and they say, oh, those people, they just go through the forms and it's meaningless. There's nothing inside it. So for outsiders, and even sometimes for Christians, when they watch a worship service, all they see is an empty kimono and they don't understand why there's any meaning in it for anyone.
So if we're taking some of these principles and applying them to Christian worship, here are some things that I notice and some assumptions that I have, and I want to see what you think. By the way, we should say that author Susan Spann is a member of Epiclesis. We're a, I like to say, pre-denominational evangelical church, Orthodox with a lowercase o, evangelical with a lowercase e. We're Bible-believing, Jesus-loving.
No empty kimono church.
No. But it seems to me that in some ways, Christian worship should be no drama. And by that, I mean, we should tell the story and we should hold to it firmly and tell it each and every time we gather. But on the flip side of the coin, we don't want to be a no drama in that the story is told in such a way that it is impenetrable and nobody gets it.
Exactly. And I think that the challenge with worship generally is, how do you make it meaningful without changing it in a way that makes it appealing but not accurate? You know, no drama. Had the troops decided to cater to the modern taste, they would have brought in more instruments. You know, you're never going to see an electric guitar on a no stage. I'm not saying electric guitar has no place in a church, because
no.
I know plenty use them.
Sure. I know what you're saying.
But I think that the reality is that if you're going to present a story that's based on an ancient tradition, whether it's no, whether it's Shakespeare, or whether it's based on the Bible, if you are going to present a tradition that's based on an ancient story, as a writer, I especially feel that you have an obligation to that story. The story is the way the author made it, and you, as a performer, don't have a right to change it just to suit your feelings.
It occurs to me that my mentor, Robert Weber, is often fond of talking about the story, the narrative, and especially in a post-Christian and post-modern world that is suspicious of meta-narratives, but also embraces story. We need, as Christians, to get back to this fundamental thing where we say the story is paramount. We need to tell God's big story each time we gather, like the no drama does. But unlike the no drama, style really isn't, I mean, for me, it's a tired red herring. I don't want to talk about style. I'm tired of the style wars. There are 1,000 colors on the palette. There are 1,000 musical styles. There's all kinds of ways to tell the big story. But we need to make sure that whatever style we're using, we're telling the story in a way that is accessible and understandable to those who are present.
I agree with that completely. I don't think there's any one way to do worship or to tell the story. I find it far more important to remember that the story is for everyone. It's for every person. It's not only for people who look a certain way or who have a certain structure to their lives. And that's another important aspect of it, which is that I think when we tell this story in a way which is exclusive, then we lose the track of the story itself.
One assumption that the no drama makes is that people in the audience will already be intimately familiar with the story and understand even the many subtle gestures and staging and symbols and so on. And I think it's terribly important that we don't make that assumption. We don't need to compromise on the story, but we also don't need to tell it in a way that is so inside baseball, if I can mix metaphors, that people don't have an opportunity to jump in and understand God's big story.
And I think one of the things that I was trying to do in that scene as well is, even though Father Mateo is an outsider and he doesn't understand it, and he's kind of laughing at it because it's humorous to him because it's so impenetrable, Hiro continues to try to explain the story to him and is patient with him and accepts even the joking around to a point far beyond where Hiro normally would, because he wants to make this story accessible to his friend.
One other thing occurs to me as our time begins to come to a close. It occurred to me that we ought to at least touch on this notion, and that is, in 16th century Japan, we very much have a situation where everyone knows their place and they have a function in the kingdom. And that is a theme that really popped out to me, especially in this novel. Susan, were you trying to highlight that particularly this time around?
I really was. You know, when I start to write a new novel, I start from a setting normally. And in this case, I knew I wanted my setting to be the theater world of Kyoto in the 16th century. But the second jumping off point that inspired this novel was, all right, so we have this fascinating, beautiful aspect of the culture, but it is also regimented in its way. Every person within a theater troupe knew their place, knew where they belonged. And I thought, what would happen, given that only men could perform on the stage in this era? If a young woman growing up had great talent as an actor, as a singer, as a dancer, but was forbidden the path that she wanted to walk? And what if she refused to stay in her place as society defined it? What if she decided to take her life into her own hands and what might happen to her? And that girl is Emmy, the victim in The Ninja's Daughter.
It also occurs to me that this pattern of people who understand their role in society, in the kingdom, as it were, because we are talking about a feudal system, right, where there are lords and peasants and people who understand their different roles in the kingdom.
Absolutely.
It also occurs to me that these people in the greater society also know where they fit into things. And to the North American mind, this is really frustrating. And we, I suppose, as contemporary Americans, we say, oh my goodness, that's terrible. People should be able to go and do what they want to do and all of these things. But you've set the novel in 16th century Japan where that is not the case. And it occurred to me that there's something that we as Christians can learn from this. And one of them is we are in a kingdom and we have a sovereign and we have been given certain skills and abilities and we serve at his pleasure. Don't you think there's some things we can learn about that as Christians?
I think that very commonly the modern mind looks at the idea of having a place, or its flip side, knowing your place, and sees it as a negative.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some real positive aspects to having a place, because by definition, if you have a place, you have a place. And the emphasis means a lot. If there is a job for you to do, it means you have a job to do. It means that society comes around you and supports you and takes care of you.
Yeah, there's some safety there.
There is some safety there. And within the theater guilds, on the one hand, yes, it was a negative. But people did have options. There's a difference between having a place and having, you know, being a slave or
right.
having no options.
Right.
And I think that there is a beauty to knowing what you are gifted to do and what you've been called to do and following your calling, because there is a great comfort in knowing that you belong.
Susan Spann, what is your place in God's kingdom? What have you been called to do?
I write novels.
Yeah.
I share stories with people, and hopefully I encourage people, because one of the things that I feel quite deeply is my personal calling is not only to tell stories, but to reach out to people, not just people who share my worldview, and to love people for who they are, not to expect them to be something different, but to try and help them to find their calling and to find their place and to encourage them to find it, to embrace it, and to be the very best that they can be called to be.
The Apostle Paul says that we are God's poema, his workmanship, which means work of art, and you create works of art with your words. And as far as I'm concerned, Susan, you are a work of art as well. Thank you for sharing with us today. My guest has been author Susan Spann. The fourth in her wonderful series of the Shinobi Mysteries comes out this week. It's called The Ninja's Daughter. And Susan, I guess we can just point people to Amazon or their local booksellers, right?
Absolutely. The books are available everywhere at national and independent bookstores all over the nation. In fact, it's released in English all over the world in trade paperback and ebook formats. And for those in the Sacramento area, I will be actually signing books and appearing and doing a reading at the Avid Reader at 1601 Broadway in Sacramento at 2 p.m. on Saturday, the 13th of August. And I will be at Face in a Book in El Dorado Hills at 6 p.m. on Friday, the 26th of August. And so if people are interested in hearing more about the books or just coming out and saying hello, getting a book signed, I would love to see people there, and I invite them to come out and join us.
And I would encourage people to get the book and read it. This one in particular may teach us something. In fact, I know it will teach us something about Christian worship and our place in the kingdom. Susan Spann, thank you so much for dropping by. It's always a pleasure. Anytime you want to come, you're just warmly welcome.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much for having me on. I always love talking with you.
Folks, until next time, when we gather again to talk about ancient future things, I want you to remember this. Keep it in mind. Surely the road to our evangelical future runs through our ancient Christian past. The Lord be with you.
Thank you for joining us for another look at ancient future faith. There is a refreshing wind of renewal blowing through the evangelical church as more and more worshipers turn for inspiration to the rich language and pattern of the ancient church. and they're rediscovering classic Christianity and learning to draw strength from a deep well of time-tested truth and tradition. Want to experience ancient future faith for yourself? Join us for worship at Epiclesis in Sacramento on Sunday mornings at 10:30 a.m. in the chapel at 4600 Winding Way. You can contact us by calling 916-572-9113 or online at epiclesis.org. That's 916-572-9113 or on the web at epiclesis.org.
Hi folks, it's Pastor Chris with one more word before we sign off. The long season after Pentecost is the perfect time to experience worship at Epiclesis, or maybe jump into a small group. There's always something happening at Epiclesis, and we'd love to have you be a part of it. Think about joining us for worship this summer. You'll be warmly welcome. As always, find more information on the web at epiclesis.org. That's epiclesis.org. The Lord be with you, and see you next Monday afternoon at 4 p.m. for another edition of Ancient Future Faith.